Well, turn again then in your Bibles to Proverbs chapter 8, this chapter that we shall be looking at for a few minutes this evening. And I guess then the outstanding feature of this passage, the feature which sets it apart from most other passages in Proverbs and indeed most other passages in the Bible, is its style. It's this literary device which is used so consistently throughout it, the literary device which we generally call personification. Now, personification then is where something which actually isn't a person is to some extent at least presented as though it were a person, as though it possessed speech and consciousness and feelings and self-determination and all those other attributes which make a person a person. Personification is where something which doesn't actually possess those attributes is treated as though it does. And here then, it is of course wisdom which is being treated that way. Wisdom here is being treated as a person. Now, I taught this morning about our passage in Revelation, possibly ringing bells with you and creating a sense of déjà vu, because of course it was really just a repeat of the previous passage in Revelation. And similarly, actually, Proverbs 8 here, this passage, it isn't without a fairly recent precedent. I'm talking about chapter 1, verses 20 to 33. There, similarly, we have the personification of wisdom. There, too, wisdom is presented as a person. But while chapter 1, verses 20 to 33, does indeed establish then a precedent, it's very much the warm-up act. This personification of wisdom here in chapter 8, lasting an epic 36 verses, it's a bolder and weightier thing altogether than that other passage in chapter 1. But I suppose the question we need to consider this evening is this: why does the author of Proverbs use this device? Why doesn't he just write in straightforward prose, in simple, unadorned propositions? What does this distinctive style bring to our passage? What does it have to offer? How does it benefit? Why does the author use it? And I just want to give three answers to that question. First of all, it's vivid. It's vivid. Now, if I were asked to sum up the main point of this whole passage in a single sentence, that single sentence might go something like this: true wisdom, the wisdom that really matters, is primarily ethical in its orientation. I would answer something like that. In other words, true wisdom is about doing what is right. True wisdom is about obeying God. It's not about academic ability, having a brain the size of Texas. That's not wisdom. It's interesting, isn't it, that in that passage with which we began our service this evening, 1 Corinthians 1, Paul talks about those not being wise by worldly standards. So there is a worldly standard of wisdom, a worldly definition. This world has an idea of wisdom, and I guess often it is just that one, isn't it? It's about academic ability, it's about being clever. Our passage is saying that true wisdom isn't about being clever. Nor is true wisdom even about being sensible, about making smart and sensible decisions. There's been much debate this past week about Tesco. And as you probably heard then, the CEO of Tesco, Dave Lewis, he announced these past days that they're going to try and address their falling profits by closing 43 stores around the country. And this, as I say, has prompted much debate. And some then are talking about this as commercial suicide. This is the beginning of the end for the giant supermarkets. Whereas others, on the other hand, are saying, well, this is brave leadership by Dave Lewis. This is true wisdom. And I guess as long as we're conscious that we're using the word in a very loose and a very weak sense, it's perhaps not illegitimate to use the word in those kinds of contexts. So talk about sensible, common sense decisions in terms of wisdom. We do use the word in that way. But as I say, we need to be conscious when we do so. We're using it in a fairly loose and a fairly weak sense. Biblically speaking, true wisdom is something much higher than merely sensible decisions. It is, as I say, doing what is right. True wisdom is obeying God's commands. So that, I'm saying, is the main point of Proverbs chapter 8. And of course, the author could have simply stated that in the way that I've just stated it. He could have put it in straightforward propositional language. But you see, he's a communicator, this author. And he wants us to really take this on board. He wants us to get this. And so he communicates it in a more vivid manner than just stating it in propositions. If you're a parent with a young child, it's dinner time and you want your child to eat his veg, then you might not just kind of run coldly through all the beneficial properties of that carrot on his plate. Instead, you might put the carrot on the end of the fork and hold it in front of your child and get the carrot to address your child. You know, eat me, I'm full of vitamins, I'll make you big and healthy and strong and all the rest. Perhaps it's just me that does that, I don't know, but you might do that. And in doing so, it's personification, isn't it? And you're doing it because you hope that that will resonate with the child, that that will leave an impression on the child that cold propositions would not do so. And similarly then, here in our passage we have wisdom speaking. We have wisdom making claims about her ethical orientation. Instead of the writer just saying, well, true wisdom is ethical, we have instead wisdom herself speaking and making claims to that end. So just to show you some examples then, in verse 6 and B, the second half of the verse, we have wisdom saying, from my lips will come what is right. So claiming there rightness, moral rectitude. Verse 7, we have wisdom again speaking and saying that wickedness is an abomination to my lips. Verse 8, all the words of my mouth are righteous. There is nothing twisted or crooked in them. Or look at the second half of verse 13. This is again wisdom then saying, pride and arrogance and the way of evil and perverted speech I hate. Verse 20, I walk in the way of righteousness, in the paths of justice. And there are other examples we could point to, but you see the point then, that instead of the writer just stating wisdom is primarily a moral thing, instead we have wisdom herself speaking and claiming righteousness and purity and holiness and all the rest of it. But actually the most vivid part of the personification comes after that. It comes in verses 22 to 31. And in verses 22 to 31 then we have this focus on creation. And really, these verses are saying the same thing as chapter 3, verses 19 and 20. In chapter 3, verses 19 and 20, we do have just kind of cold statements, propositions. The Lord, by wisdom, founded the earth. By understanding, he established the heavens, and so on. So there, chapter 3, 19 to 20, is saying that when God created, he created with great wisdom. And here, chapter 8, verses 22 to 31, it's saying the same thing. It's saying that when God created, he created with great wisdom. But here then, wisdom, instead of being presented as merely the attribute of God that was exercised in creation, here, in keeping with this whole style of our chapter, wisdom is presented as an actual person involved alongside God in the creation of the universe. Now, we don't actually have wisdom doing the creating here. That would probably detract too much from the glory of the Creator God. But we do have then in verses 30 and 31 instead wisdom celebrating. That's the emphasis, isn't it? Reveling in God's creative acts. Rejoicing, delighting. By the way, there in the middle of verse 30, I think the footnote reading is preferable. Wisdom saying, not I was daily God's delight, but rather I was daily filled with delight, rejoicing before him always. So instead then of it saying just coldly, God did it, God created with great wisdom, it's saying much more vividly, much more imaginatively, much more poetically, God did it, and wisdom was looking on in pleasure and delight as he did it. It's the same thing, but it's saying it in this very vivid and memorable manner. But there's something else to notice here. In this little snapshot of creation, the work of creation that we're given in these verses, what feature is being particularly emphasized? There in chapter 3, 19 to 20, it's particularly the stability of the creation that has been emphasized. The stability language abounds there. The Lord by wisdom founded the earth. By understanding, he established the heavens. And it's emphasizing then the stability of the creation. What feature is being emphasized here? Well, I think the answer is its orderliness, if I could use that word. Its orderliness. The way in which the creation is characterized by very clearly defined boundaries. It's not just this great mess. God has kind of thrown all these different components together and they all kind of merge into one another and it's all just a big mess. That's what my paintings used to look like when I did art at school. But that's not what the creation looks like. Instead, look at verses 27 and 28. There are these very clear kind of distinctions. We have the heavens at the start of verse 27, and then we have the deep in the second second half of verse 27. Again, in verse 28, the skies being contrasted sharply with the fountains of the deep. And then this theme reaches its climax in very, very strong language in verse 29, where we have this idea then of the seas, again, can have been given boundaries. There's a part of the creation where the seas are, and they have to stay there. But this very strong language used then, he assigned the sea its limits so that the waters might not transgress his command. And so, as I say, it's this theme of orderliness. And that then is what in verses 30 to 31, wisdom is delighting in. As wisdom looks on, so delighted, so pleased with what God is doing, it's particularly, it seems, this orderliness that wisdom is taking pleasure in. In other words, then, because God created the world with wisdom, not only is it a very stable, strong, robust world, that's the emphasis in chapter 3, But also, it's a very orderly world with clearly defined boundaries that the different components, like the sea, do not transgress. And the point then of all that is, I think, this. That when wisdom is present in our lives, then our lives, our behavior, just like the sea, will respect God's boundaries. In this case, of course, moral boundaries, God's commandments, the laws which God has set us. God's wisdom in creation results in boundaries not being crossed. And similarly then, God's wisdom in our behavior, in our conduct, will result in moral boundaries not being crossed. And again then, it's this idea, which I'm saying is the main point of the whole passage, that wisdom is not primarily about cleverness or about even sensibleness, if that's a word, but wisdom is primarily about obedience. It's about doing God's commands. Which raises the question then, before we move on to our second point, are we wise tonight? Are you wise in that biblical sense? I'm not asking, are you clever? I'm not asking about your academic record. I'm not asking, could you walk into Tesco's and turn it round by making a series of sensible decisions? I'm asking, are you prioritizing, taking seriously God's commands? God's commands, which of course we find summed up for us, don't we, in the Ten Commandments of Scripture, and then summed up even more, I suppose, in the two commands that Jesus spoke of, loving God and loving our neighbour. That's wisdom. Forget what anybody else says. Proverbs 8 is saying to us, that's wisdom. So, why this style? Well, first of all, it's vivid. But then secondly, it's appropriate. It's appropriate. You see, this passage, it doesn't only want us to be wise. It doesn't only want us to practice wisdom. It also wants us to love wisdom. Indeed, it wants us to love wisdom with the kind of intensity that we might normally associate with loving a person. And thus, I'm saying it's appropriate that wisdom is presented as a person. Because the kind of love that we might normally think of showing toward a person, Proverbs 8 wants us to show toward wisdom. And so love and desire and romantic language punctuates the passage, doesn't it? Verse 17 and 21, most explicitly, verse 17, I love those who love me, loving wisdom. And verse 21, granting inheritance to those who love me. Or verse 11, wisdom is better than jewels, all that you may desire cannot compare with her. So again then, wisdom being presented not just as a thing to be done, a thing to be practiced, but as an object of desire. Or verse 34, where we have the language of romantic trysts almost. Blessed is the one who listens to me. That's wisdom still speaking. Watching daily at my gates, waiting beside my doors. And it's reminiscent of the Song of Solomon, chapter 5, where we have the man pursuing his beloved and knocking on her door. It's a language that then Jesus takes up in Revelation 3:20 regarding the church in Laodicea. And we have similar language here then. And we've been encouraged here to kind of pursue wisdom, like we're in love with wisdom, in almost a romantically intense way. Or verse 35, where it says, whoever finds me finds life. And the verb find there, it's the same one in the Hebrew that was used in chapter 7, verse 15, where we have that adulteress, that alluring woman. And she's saying to this man whom she's trying to seduce, she's saying, I've come out to meet you, to seek you eagerly, and I have found you. And she's basically trying to convey the impression to him, look, you are the man of my dreams. You're the one I've been looking for. You're my Mr. Right. Now, we said last time, it's specious. It's false. And she shouldn't be trusted in what she's saying. But that's the language she's using. And the word then, in that context, this word find, it means then there can be end of a romantic quest. And it's the same word that's used here of us finding wisdom in verse 35 there. And so, as I say, the passage clearly wants us to love wisdom. And that's challenging, isn't it? That's more challenging than just the exhortation to practice it. Think of Jesus' famous parable in Luke 15, the parable of the lost son. And that intriguing character who comes in at the end, the elder brother. And remember how he says to his father, these many years I have served you, and I never disobeyed your command. And there's no reason to believe he's lying there. The father doesn't refute that claim. He has been a very faithful, a very diligent son, it seems. But it becomes very clear in what he says immediately after that, that while he's been an obedient son, there's no love for obeying his father. Because he goes on to say, and yet you have never given me so much as a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. There's resentment there. There's diligent external obedience, but it's not a labor of love for that elder brother. And perhaps tonight, your life is largely, as a Christian, conforming to God's commands. But perhaps over the years of your Christian life, the spirit in which you're conforming your life to God's commands has become more and more like the spirit of that elder brother in the parable. And I think we need to say this, that obedience in those circumstances, wisdom, where we don't actually love wisdom, where we don't actually have a great relish for it, it can only be sustained so long. You see, I'm sure we're meant to place Proverbs 8 within its context. And we're supposed to see it in connection with the previous chapter. It can't be mere coincidence that in both chapters, of course, we have a woman at the centre of it. And in chapter 7, and as I mentioned just now, it's this alluring, enticing, adulterous woman, whereas here in chapter 8 then, it's personified wisdom. You see, think about that young man in chapter 7 who is seduced. And that young man, he's described in chapter 7, verse 7. And he's described in fairly moderate terms, a young man lacking sense. He's not described in the strong language that Proverbs often uses as a fool or a wicked man. It's not that this man was just kind of going out looking for sin, that he was just a debaucherous young man. It seems that he was the sort of young man who generally did live a fairly decent life. And probably every day he successfully resisted all kinds of temptations But he doesn't resist this one. And why doesn't he resist this one then? Why is he seduced here? Well, I think chapter 8 is giving us the answer. And it's saying to us that the reason that he fell for the charms of this woman was because he'd never really fallen for the charms of wisdom. He fell in love with this woman because he hadn't really fallen in love with this other woman, wisdom. And yes, he had a moral compass, perhaps. And yes, he had an instinct for respectable living, perhaps, which had served him well throughout his life so far. But that couldn't serve him well this night. When such a powerful temptation came his way, it wasn't enough to hold him back. And similarly then, if we find ourselves obeying but not loving obedience, not being able to say, in the language of the Beatitudes, I hunger and thirst for righteousness. I don't just do it, but I find it attractive, I find it beautiful, I find it lovely, I hunger and thirst for it, then that obedience in our lives will at some point meet the kind of overwhelming challenge that that young man met with that night in the streets. And so we need to be, as Christians, praying, don't we, for that deep hunger and thirst within us for wisdom. Praying not just for the practice of it, but for the love of it. And seeking to cultivate such a hunger and thirst. And seeking to have that desire for wisdom that is almost of the kind of intensity that we would normally associate with desiring a person. Is that us tonight? Are we wise? That was my first question. But the second question, do we love wisdom? So, why this style in our chapter? Well, it's vivid, it's appropriate, but then thirdly and finally this evening, it's suggestive. It's suggestive. The other day, when those police forces in France were besieging that warehouse where the two brothers were hiding, it was commented several times by the journalists, by the reporters, just what a sleepy little place this was that had suddenly become the focus of all his activity. I can't remember the name of the place, I probably couldn't pronounce it if I could, but this village in France there, normally just a sleepy little place, and an unlikely place then for all these police to suddenly descend upon and for all this drama to suddenly take place in. And it's a bit like that, perhaps, if I tell you that throughout church history, Proverbs chapter 8 has been the focal point of much high-level theological argument and conflict. Indeed, it's been a proof text for those who would deny the very deity of our Lord Jesus Christ. And you might say, well, it's such a sleepy passage, Proverbs 8. I mean, it's so innocuous. It's nice poetry, and it has these important things to say about wisdom and all the rest of it. But a focal point for those who would seek to deny the deity of Jesus, how on earth can Proverbs 8 be that? Well, those who have done so have argued like this, that here this speaker in Proverbs 8 talks about the Lord in verse 22 there, possessing, the ESV has, probably influenced by all these debates, but more literally bringing to birth, bringing me to birth at the beginning of his work. This speaker talks about being the kind of the first thing that God ever created. And so those who used the passage in this way said, well, Jesus then was the first thing God created. He wasn't eternal. He was certainly before anything else. God created him first. God brought him into being before he brought anything else into being. But he can't be God if he's not eternal. Now, you're probably immediately thinking, well, what's Jesus got to do with all of this? This is wisdom speaking, we've been saying. This is wisdom being personified and so speaking. What's Jesus got to do with it? And that is, I think, a very fair question. And that, I think, does really end the debate that this isn't Jesus speaking. This is a personification of wisdom speaking. So there's no problem with the speaker saying that I was created first before anything else, because it's not Jesus speaking. It's wisdom that's speaking. And so we need to be clear on that. And if we ever encounter anyone using Proverbs 8 as an argument against the deity of Christ, we need to be clear that Proverbs 8 isn't really about Christ at all. Having said that, I think it must be conceded that the language here is at least suggestive. Because, of course, the way that wisdom is described here, it does kind of naturally make you think of texts about Jesus, doesn't it? Particularly in John's Gospel. Remember, I was preaching a couple of weeks ago on a Sunday evening on Romans 8:3, and I raised the question, you know, what was the Son of God doing before he became incarnate, before he came to this world, before he became a man? And I said that there are these very slim windows that we are given, especially in John's Gospel. We're given John 1:1 there, that he was with God, face to face with God. It's the preposition toward rather than with, really. Or there in John 5, Jesus talking about doing whatever the Father shows him. And again, then, perhaps a little window into this intimate, beautiful relationship between Father and Son before Jesus ever came to earth. And you can see then that this speaker in verse 30, talking about being beside God at creation and rejoicing before God at creation, you can see that it does naturally make you think of texts like that about Jesus there in the Gospel of John. And I don't think we should discount those natural links altogether. But then you say, well, surely then that just leads us back to the first problem that I raise. And if we're going to see Jesus here at all, then we're plunging ourselves into deep trouble, because then we are leaving ourselves open to the charge, well, Jesus therefore cannot be God. To which my response would be this, that to the extent that Jesus then is present here, or the extent that to which Jesus is present here, is in the form of a type. You familiar with that word type? You know how we talk then about various persons and institutions and things in the Old Testament which are types of Jesus. In other words, they point forward to Jesus. Now, they're not Jesus, but they do point forward to some degree to Jesus. And I think that's what we have here with wisdom. This isn't Jesus speaking. And so the whole charge that, well, Jesus can't be God because of Proverbs 8, that is invalid, because this isn't Jesus. This is wisdom. But wisdom is a type of Jesus. And it's part of the essence of types that only certain aspects of them point forward to Jesus. So we say David was a type of Jesus. But of course, David wasn't a type of Jesus when he was rushing out to gain revenge on Nabal, who had slighted him and was wanting to kill the man who had offended him like that. He wasn't a type of Jesus then. We say Samson was a type of Jesus. But Samson wasn't a type of Jesus when he went and spent a night with a prostitute in Gaza. And so you see my point, that types, in certain ways, they point forward to Jesus, but not everything about them points forward to Jesus. And that's what we have here. Yes, in the sense that wisdom is here described as being beside God at the beginning and delighting before God. Yeah, that points us to Jesus as he's described in John's Gospel, as he describes himself in John's Gospel. But when it says that the Lord made me at the beginning of his work, well, that doesn't apply to Jesus, because we know that Jesus is eternal God. Well, so what, you might be saying at the end of all this? Well, I suppose, quite apart from those texts in John's Gospel, there is another strand of New Testament text which kind of bears out slightly what I've just been saying about Jesus here. And it's those texts from the pen of the Apostle Paul where Jesus is described as wisdom. We read one at the start of our service tonight, 1 Corinthians 1 there, that Jesus has become wisdom from God. Similarly, in Colossians 2, in him, in Jesus, are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Jesus is wisdom incarnate, those passages from Paul are saying. And what we have here then is a type of Jesus. And what that means as we close is this. I've been saying tonight that as Christians then we need to be wise and we need to love wisdom and we need to prioritize wisdom, i.e. doing what God commands. Perhaps tonight you're not a Christian. And you might get the wrong end of the stick tonight and you might think, well, okay, so what I need to do is go away and obey God's commands and be wise. It's a good thought, but it's not actually possible. The Bible teaches that we cannot by ourselves, as we are by nature, as we are born in that state, we cannot obey God's commands. We can't be wise. We can't practice wisdom. And the significance then of Jesus being called the wisdom of God by Paul in those two texts and one or two other places is that if you want to be wise, you need to go to Jesus. Paul said there in 1 Corinthians 1, didn't he, that actually Jesus is lots of things. And he talked about Jesus being righteousness. That means that if you go to Jesus, then God will declare you righteous. On the basis of what Jesus has done, despite all your sins and all your guilt, God will declare you righteous. But he also says then that if you go to Jesus, he will not only declare, God will not only declare you righteous, but then through Jesus, he will impart to you, he will give to you all the wisdom you need to obey God's commands throughout the rest of your life. And so I encourage you at the close to do that if you're not a Christian tonight. Don't go away thinking, right, I need to obey God's commands. Go away thinking, right, I need to go to Jesus. I need to trust in him. I need to become a believer in Jesus. And then God will wonderfully declare me righteous. Jesus will become my righteousness. But also, Jesus will become my wisdom, my ability, my enabling, my empowering to obey God's commands and be a different person. Go to Jesus. Amen. Well, let's close with hymn 638. Be thou my